Hello and welcome. I want to say a little bit about how I actually have a PhD in social psychology and came to the study of affordable housing because I was interested in what factors in the ecology of the city made the most difference in the well-being of a household and in the development of the child and of the family's trajectory into a better or a worse situation. And I began doing that work, and I found that the people I interviewed were almost obsessed with their housing, with its insecurity, with its, the problems of its location, with the problems of its just the condition of the housing, with the cost of it, and that in any open-ended interview, this is all they really wanted to talk about. They would sometimes answer my other questions, but it wasn't on their mind. And that, over time, began to sink into me that this was a very important aspect of the ecology of human development and of well-being in inner cities. And so I've organized the talk to first take a look at how it is that housing matters in human development. So this is something that I call the housing niche model that looks at how families are channeled into particular locations within the geography of an area, but also as particular types of housing, like ownership or rental or public housing. And those things have to do with the factors at the top, which have to do with the characteristics and experiences and connections of households themselves. And then those things on the bottom, which are determined more by public policy, by societal factors, by the local ecology that may have nothing really to do with the household. Both of those things determine where you're going to go. So whether or not you buy a home or rent a home depends on your income. Where you're able to do that may depend to some extent on your ethnicity, on your household structure, and it will also depend on whether there are any subsidy programs in the area, what the housing market is locally, what policies have supported the production of affordable rental housing and made it profitable for developers or not, a whole host of factors. But so you have what I call G1, that's the first, the generation that gets into housing. All those factors go into placing them in a housing ecology. And for your attention to schools, that means it also places them in a school district. And it places them with regard to recreational opportunities and to neighbors and role models and so on. And so then let's say at time two, they have a child. And so it places, the child has been placed by the parents' characteristics in a particular ecology through the location of the housing. And in that place, they'll be able to go to the particular schools that are in the area. That will also be affected by how much the housing costs. If it doesn't cost the family's whole budget, then they might be able to go to private school. They'll be subject to certain hazards like crime or amenities like nice outdoor spaces and good shopping and clean streets and so on because of their location. And all of that affects the child's capacity to develop. And it also affects the parents' well-being and the parents' level of stress and demand. For example, many people, as we'll see later, have very high housing costs, and so they have to work more than one job, which then makes them less available for parenting. In some early work I did in public housing, we see that this affects then parents who are stressed out economically because of their housing are exposed to trying environmental conditions, tend to be less supportive parents. And then that affects the child's capacity to be well-developed and to perform well in school. And then the child's independent exposure to, for example, violence in the community also affects that. So the dynamics in the household get affected and development gets affected. Then later on, the child, during this period, then the child is acquiring its human capital, such as education, and its future financial capital, possibly through the investment in a home ownership situation by the parents, which is the greatest source of wealth and often the source of income that pays for college or can be borrowed against to pay for college. And then when the time comes, all of those factors affect the kind of housing the child can child generation can buy. And I think that's all related to the intergenerational cycle of poverty and issues related to breaking it. And also shows the complexity of it, because if the housing is unstable and insecure, then the educational experience is constantly disrupted, and that's been shown to be bad. Plus, there are many studies recently showing that children who parents own homes, especially low-income children's parents who own homes, are more likely to complete college and to have a higher level of educational and occupational achievement. So homeownership is a very important factor for families. It is the largest contributor to wealth for all families, but especially for low-income families who have pretty much no other sources of wealth accumulation. And again, this is really important for determining whether or not a child goes to college, whether this is happening in the household. You can see from these statistics that homeowner wealth is 81% of the 81-to-1 kind of assets, so the other one would be whether, so they lower income people tend not to have almost any stocks and bonds or very little pension funds and so forth. Housing affordability has also been a problem for decades in the United States, especially for the lower, for a while it was the lower 20%, eked up to the lower 40%, in some cases the lower 50%. And these are just some statistics. I'm not going to go over each one, but the upshot of it is that very many households in the United States pay more than a third of their income for housing, and that a minimum wage job really isn't adequate. In this next slide, these are all taken from the most recent State of the Nation's Housing Report at Harvard. And you can see that no household that had only one full-time minimum wage earner in it could afford a modest two-bedroom any place in the United States by fair market rents. Then the bottom 25%, devoting more than half their incomes to housing, spend on average $123 less on food. There has also been shown to be a linkage between housing conditions in childhood and health in later life. $86 less on health care and $20 less on clothing. They're probably not having a lot of excess income then that they can spend on things like higher education. Even before the recession, the share of minority homeowners with equity cushions of more than 5%, which means that they really could get something out of their homes if they sold them or wanted to borrow against it, was much higher than for whites. Now it's very high. Everyone's equity cushion has gotten thinner, but that's particularly bad. There are also racial differences in how much good it does you to buy a home. Many studies have found that African Americans tend to buy homes and be steered into homes. There's a whole set of steering studies, testing studies, where they send out people with the same credentials who are white and black and see what happens to where they get channeled into the housing market. And even as late as 2 years ago, there were serious channeling effects going on in a national study. So they tend to be channeled into places that are less likely to appreciate. Their low-income homeowners also often really aren't prepared to be homeowners financially and return to renting. They don't benefit from it as much because the deduction isn't as valuable to them. And the high cost of loans for them, and I don't know how much you know about this, you can ask questions later, but home ownership expanded drastically among African Americans and among low-income people with the invention of the subprime loan, which allowed banks and financial institutions to charge higher interest rates to cover their risk. That turned out not to be true. And therefore, they thought they could lend to lower-income people, but they had to pay more for that loan, so that instead of paying 6%, they might have to pay 9.5%. And then they also put a lot of high fees on it, so that if they missed a payment, it could double, the interest rate could double, they'd have a late payment fee, et cetera. So there are ways the banks thought they were going to be safe as one of the vice presidents of Washington Mutual in New York said to me, we have no skin in the game. It doesn't matter how many people we loan to in this low-income bracket. That didn't turn out to be true. There were also barriers. So this is a study of low-income homeowners that I did with colleagues in 2005. We were asked by NeighborWorks America to look at their people who'd received home ownership counseling and to see how they were faring. And we found, and we learned some things about the process of buying a home and the things that stood out the most. And of course, affordability was still the biggest barrier, even after education had been accomplished, although there were some other issues. But the big thing that came out of that study that was troubling to our funders, who included, besides NeighborWorks America, it also included Freddie Mac and the New York Home Loan Bank, the Federal Home Loan Bank of New York, and a bunch of other banks, who thought that this homeowner education might be the solution to being sure that these loans were paid and so on. But we found that even after all of that education, that many people 10 to 15 years later were getting in trouble with their loans. And so they asked us to do some focus groups to find out, here's how the bankers saw it. If they just called their lender, we could work something out so that they wouldn't have to be delinquent, that we'd do what they called a loan modification. But they don't call us. So they ask us to talk to people and find out why they weren't calling. The first thing we found out, this was also at a time when the banks viewed foreclosure problems as self-curing. So they were, I'd say, in denial in like the summer of 2006 about the impending crisis. They were like, yes, well, some people are getting into trouble, but first of all, we've priced everything so that we're protected from risk. And second, most home loans, most mortgage delinquencies are self-curing. People figure it out. So there's just a tiny slice of people. We should educate them. But since then, the crisis has expanded, obviously. And we, unfortunately, were like canaries in a coal mine a little bit then, because once we got into the ground, on the ground, and started talking to people, it was clear this was a big problem. It was also clear that people were asking for help. They were asking everybody they could find for help, but they were not, banks were not putting them through to the loan modification section. They were connecting them with the bill collectors, who would then harass them. And I'll get into what other things happened to them. But they were asking for but not getting help. Further, there were some systemic issues that had gone on that made it very difficult to do modifications, which bankers at that time were unaware of. Bernanke was unaware of that as late as, or didn't wasn't willing to talk about it publicly, as late as 2007. And even in 2008, at the beginning of 2008, he was beginning to understand that the securitization of all these mortgages had created problems where a modification was very difficult to do, and a set of incentives for banks that made it also problematic for them to go ahead and do those modifications. So since 2006, this problem has exploded, and about 1 in 10 people, households in the United States who have loans are now in danger of foreclosure. Or in foreclosure. And by all accounts, that's increasing. And for low and moderate income people, the rate is much higher. And we're now entering a second phase of the crisis, which is the first phase was mainly around bad loans. This phase now is around much harder to cure problems like loss of income or complete loss of jobs. And all the while, debt is mounting for people who are trying to keep their heads above water. But when we talk to homeowners about this, their first response, they had two kinds of strategies. Their first strategy was to try to work harder and to control their budgets. And most of them were taking on as many jobs as they could get, although, as we'll see in our next slide, many of them, the crisis was triggered by a health event or a loss of income because of death or divorce or something like that. So even if the people left standing were able to work harder, there was still often a hole. But so they believed at the beginning, and almost everybody believed, that if they worked hard enough, they would get out of debt. But then there was a refrain. It was almost like in one of those call and answer kind of services in some church, where we'd start going around and everybody'd say, my story's just like hers, but I got cancer. My story's just like his, but my car broke down and then I had to repair it or else I'd lose my job, and then I got behind on my mortgage payment. And so they had all had this like event, sometimes a very minor event, like a car breaking down or something like that. Very often the majority of them had health-related events cause them to lose income for a while, sometimes cause them to lose their jobs, and sometimes just cause them to become very indebted. We also found that it wasn't always their own health problems, because low-income homeowners, as this last bullet here says, usually have the most resources of anybody in their social network. So they're the ones people go to when they're in trouble. And many of them continue to support nephews, sisters, elderly mothers, to spend their money, having to decide that they're going to spend money on their dying mother's health care rather than on their mortgage. So they weren't going to be getting a lot of help. But for many of them, as little as $400 at the beginning of the crisis would have saved them. Some of the difficulties they encountered in seeking help were that there was non-response or threatening debt collection, loss of the banks would say they lost their check, they lost their documents, that they would falsely claim, or at least our people we talked to said they'd falsely claim the payments were late. And there were no way to get documents. There were also lengthy waits for any response. And then they would get advice like, well, don't pay your mortgage and then you'll be eligible for a modification. So then they'd get really in trouble. And then when they got to the modification stage, they'd say, well, your credit's not good enough now to do a modification. So there were a lot of catch-22s, which I think are coming out in the papers now, but at that time were not particularly well known. So people were feeling a debt squeeze, because often they would run up their credit card debt in order to pay their mortgages. They were doing all of this, but they knew that the bottom line for them was their credit score, because they couldn't really do anything to manage. They had more debt than they could pay for, no matter how hard they worked, for the most part. So they were juggling, so they were trying to be in a situation where they could still get a little bit of borrowing and switching around, paying off one debt and going a little another way. But they had a pervasive sense of unfairness about that. They said, even, this is a quote that's interesting, even the lender that bought my mortgage, they had automated calls that came to my home at 2 or 3 in the morning. I guess I can say that my attitude is zero, because I do not understand how these large corporations and these large lenders do poor people the way they do. You cross the street against the light and you get a ticket. You can't tell me that what these lenders and bankers and mortgages are doing is right. It's wrong. And I think we still see this, and now it's a much more public sentiment than it was at that time. For our focus group people, it was often the first time they'd talked in public at all to anyone about and or heard that anyone else was having trouble except themselves. So there was a kind of a prayer meeting feel about the whole thing, because they were sort of getting support from each other as well, because they thought it was only them who somehow had failed in this quest for homeownership. One thing we did find out is that homeowners wanted intervention from the government, and they were seriously upset that so little was happening. I think that's something we still see happening. And for some of the same reasons, as I was at a meeting this morning with a bunch of mortgage counselors, and they were saying, you know, the number of people who are really able to qualify for the most recent mortgage workout program that the feds have passed would fit on the head of a pin, frankly. The government sanctions rules that favor corporations. And this is something that I think everybody knows now, but when you get into the details of it, it's really interesting, and it's really interesting how it was true about the rules that regulated the lack of regulation of the lending industry at that time. And now through the workout, the same principle is preserved, which is that the banks must be capitalized, not that there should be some sharing of the pain between the borrower and the lender. And so this made people feel that they were radically at risk, because this was happening to them in their housing, but they also were facing, they had there's been a somewhat of a stripping away of, well, like, for example, the other cash income subsidies are now gone. The only safety net program that still exists is the food stamp program, which now I think 25% of the households in the United States are using, which is kind of a huge number. But people felt that even though they were working really hard and had been paying their mortgage for 10 years or something, that they would have to be completely homeless before they could get any kind of help. And their dreams were tarnished. For many, these were almost all first-time homeowners. They were very often the first member of their family to own a home. They were in communities in which homeownership was not common. And they really felt this was an achievement. And like, here's one woman who's 50 years old, and she wanted to own property, and people said, well, you're working, you should be able to do this. But her income just was not adequate to it. And as she says, I'm 50 years old, and I'm starting from scratch. Because once you lose your home, your credit record's out the window. It's very hard to even rent an apartment because you have such bad credit by then. If you go bankrupt, that's even worse. And it takes 3 to 7 years to restore your credit to a level where you'd even be considered for another home. But people were not blaming others completely. Some did. There has been evidence showing that these loans have been targeted. The academic evidence on this is very strong. The judicial system is treating it within another framework at this point, and I'm not quite sure that I understand what that framework is. But the evidence that loans were disproportionately targeted to African-American and low-income communities is really strong. African-Americans were like 100 in the same income bracket were like 120% more likely to get a bad loan, to get a high-priced loan than similar income groups that were white. And this has been studied by the Joint Center at Harvard, by many, 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 actually by the Federal Reserve Bank has put out some papers on this. It's a pretty well-established fact. On the other hand, people who were poor knew how hard this had been for them to do, how much they didn't understand, and how unprepared, in a sense, they felt. And so they also thought that education was an important part. And this connects with education in another way, too, which is that one of the things I came out of this feeling is that we should be teaching financial management from first grade onward, that this is something that we're all woefully inadequate at, but that it's really important. And the less money you have, the more important it is, actually. So people said, well, I came out of this experience knowing that I have to take responsibility and I have to teach my children about money. And I want them to be one of those people who can sit at this, on the side of the table, that have the clout to negotiate and really get what they want up front and not have to fight for tidbits. So they still believed in this dream, even though they were fairly angry and sad. And we heard threats of suicide and despair and many terrible stories. My grad students who did this actually came to me and sort of wanted me to help them get some mental health counseling or something afterwards, because it was really distressing to talk to people whose lives were destroyed. But they also said that it taught them something else about citizenship, which is that they had to vote, that somehow the government was not representing their interest. And I think we still see this issue going on today. Now, what I'd like to do, if my technical capacities are not, I want to play a little video clip for you. At the end of our focus groups, we gave people the opportunity, if they wanted to send a one-minute message to anyone that they wanted to send. And this is what we got.
I have a mortgage with Swartz & Brough out of Austin, Texas. This is the Swartz & Brough. First of all, I want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to buy a home from you, but at this time I am not satisfied with the way that you treat me, the way that you hang up in my face. I don't like it. I think you could be more professional.
I would just like to say to loan officers to please be honest when people come to you with a mortgage. If you realize that they're not going to be able to afford the mortgage, maybe they can afford it right now, but if there's a car that needs to be repaired or a surgery that needs to take place or something of that nature, if it's going to completely destroy their finances and possibly their family, if you can see this, if you can see that by their figures, they're pushing things too tight, please be honest and tell them. Don't lead them to believe that they can afford this mortgage if you're sitting there knowing in your mind that they can't.
One of the things that I did was really evaluate the debt that I was in and came to grips with it and admitted to myself that the problem I had was overspending. And from that, I created a budget and went through and reworked my finances. And I was able to, fortunately, get out of foreclosure.
Always have that open door policy. If you're offering in the beginning, keep it for that lifelong loan.
So we wanted to choose some that were positive, too, because some people who did manage to find, especially people who had FHA loans and managed to find their way to the modification department were able to work it out. And not everyone failed, and I think because the stories I heard are so infuriating often, I want to be sure that I emphasize that for those who make it into modification, they can be saved often. So these are the kinds of ideas that they had, which are not that earth-shattering, but still have not been put into practice in the Homeowner Protection Acts that have occurred. Unfortunately, all the problems we identified still exist. But so I thought it was the next phase of this talk is to evaluate the benefits of homeownership against the problems of debt and foreclosure, because despite all of this, almost none of our homeowners said they wish they'd never bought a house. They still wanted this. So what we know is that homeowners like their homes better, they have higher self-esteem, feel more effective, better general health. It has positive effects on child development and later life, which reflects a bunch of things. Some has to do with residential stability, some having to do with wealth accumulation, some having to do with possibly better neighborhoods. There are a lot of unidentified factors. But when you begin to lose the home, one of the stories we heard over and over again is how it destroys the family. We heard explicit stories of A-plus students who were now almost failing high school, and families where the parents were so stressed that they did nothing but scream each other. Many divorces were described. Many teenagers and their parents especially got into very difficult situations when there was this much stress. And also the children no longer could afford to do anything. Their parents couldn't even pay like $10 for them to join like a youth organization of their church. So there was a lot of lower sense of security, a lot of depression, a lot of family tension, decreases in physical and mental health, plus just direct effects on their financial well-being, which has a big impact on whether or not children go on to higher ed. At the community level, homeownership also has many, many benefits. Better maintenance, higher property values, more civic engagement, less crime, longer length of residence, so the community is more stable, lower. But it does increase racial and economic segregation often because of the way in which housing development occurs. And lower income and minority homeowners don't always benefit from the neighborhood qualities. Debt and foreclosure have disastrous effects on neighborhoods. They lower property values, lower maintenance, cost municipalities a ton of money, make it a dilapidated neighborhood, and increase crime. There's also some evidence that there's a lot more like drug dealing and drug use and so on in those in neighborhoods with abandonment. So if we look at the other option, which is rental housing, we see that for low and moderate income people, there's been a problem. We've been pushing home ownership now for two or three decades as a solution, and Tennessee has pushed it especially hard. There was a city program to support low and moderate income home ownership. There was a state program, and there's a federal program. They were small, I mean, in the sense that they just provided down payment assistance. But that's where the money went. There was no money for now since about 1980 really going into supporting affordable rentals. So the supply has been shrinking to almost nothing. And the vacancy rates are really in luxury buildings. So right now it's happening, well, since 2007 when this data were collected, but it's supposed, from all estimates I can hear much worse now, is that there's been a skyrocketing of homelessness, which has been reported. And there are just scattered reports of people asking about the cause of it and seeing foreclosure as one of the rising causes of it. So my conclusion of all of this is that homeownership is a better way to go for low and moderate income people, and in fact they benefit more than even upper income people, relatively speaking. And from the, I've been working around housing for like 20 years now, and control of housing is such a significant issue to people whose lives are so unstable, who are often experience unexpected evictions because of changes in ownership or rent hikes, or the apartment building burns down, or they move in criminals and they have to move out because it's too safe, unsafe. So there's great desire and some evidence of benefits, but it hasn't seemed to be sustainable, and I think our current situation is making that pretty obvious. So what I've been doing, and this is a wonderful day for me to be speaking to you, is I've been working with the housing community here in Nashville, including state and local officials and the nonprofits and so the financial institutions, to try to develop a form of home ownership which I have studied for many years. It's called shared equity home ownership. So if we invest the subsidies that we're going into helping lower income people buy homes, which had two problems. One is that it didn't always mean that they could sustain it because the subsidy wasn't deep enough. It also meant that they were on their own with regard to maintenance, repairs, and ongoing financial literacy, and were disproportionately prey to scams. A favorite scam is a contractor will come in, tell you he'll give you this great price on it, rip the house up, then tell you it's going to cost four times as much, but he has a loan lined up for you, and then this subprime lender will come in and give you this like pretty terrible loan, and there was a lot of that going on. There are many other schemes. So there are three forms of this. It's the basic premise is instead of putting the subsidy in and then letting the homeowner live with whatever happens afterwards, and also gain the subsidy. You lose every one of the things that people in Nashville who provide affordable housing were concerned about is that the demand is about 40% of the population, and it's especially serious for those who make 50% of median or below, and there's almost no supply and no ability to produce a supply. So every time you give up one homeowner the loan, it's a one-generation shot, because when they sell that home, you don't get any money and the unit doesn't stay affordable. So one of the things is to provide permanent affordability, and the other is to provide some kind of shared stewardship for the problems that people run into in homeownership. And today, we found out that Nashville won $30 million in a competitive neighborhood stabilization program on a program that I had, is being spearheaded by MDHA here and involves the Housing Fund, it involves Woodbine Community Organization, Urban Housing Solutions, and one of my graduate students basically did all of the data development and the argument for the proposal, and it will include starting a shared equity sector in Nashville. So we're pretty excited because it's the only one in the state of Tennessee. It's very competitive, and that means this will become a reality. We've been working on this idea together for about 2 years now. But so what is it? Well, it has the component of a local steward. So it's like home ownership, except you share that ownership with an organization. In this case, it would probably be the Housing Fund. And so that means that they continue, if you want to take out another loan, they also own it. So their professional staff and their lawyer and so on will look at it and see whether it's a good loan or not. They also have alternative sources of funding. So if you need a rehab loan, instead of going to Countrywide, you can go to THDA and get a very affordable kind of a rehab loan. So it provides a kind of security and financial knowledge and connections. It also helps people manage their asset, be sure the house is kept up. It provides assistance with learning how to make repairs and getting contractors and that kind of thing. And it also helps to promote public policies that make low-income homeownership permanently more affordable and stable. I'm not going to go into the formulas, that's a little too detailed. Okay, but how does it compare to renting? Well, the problems with rental, low-income rental housing, it's often dilapidated. The landlords usually don't care at all about the tenants and have no contact with them except to collect the rent and evict them. It's often unstable, especially for absentee landlords. It's unstable because if you sell it to like a shopping center development or something, all of a sudden it goes away. Usually people are renting to poor people while they're trying to sell the property for a more at a profit or higher use, because it's not that profitable to rent to poor people. And they don't get any equity. Homeowning is a much better deal. You have control over your home, but you also have to pay for repairs and pay the mortgage, the whole mortgage. And you can, but you can accumulate some equity. No equity is, no matter what you spend on your housing and rent, you're never going to walk away with anything but your security deposit. And you'll be lucky at that. Let's see what's wrong. Okay, there should be one more thing here. There we go. So shared equity gives you control over high-quality housing. Nationally, the shared equity sector is much better physically than, the, for example, public housing or low-income rentals. You do have to pay for home repairs, but you're in a situation where you have some support for that and some resources. The steward of this will assure that your initial loan is affordable and that you can, that you have a stable long-term fixed rate kind of a mortgage, and will assure that you don't take any other kind of mortgages. And you, in the end, walk away with some equity. Not all, but compared to renting, you are going to. And so just to show you how that works. So creates a permanently affordable housing stock. I think I've said everything. It's, in general, a good deal for low and moderate income homeowners. How's it work? Okay, this is if you were going to buy a house on the open market. You'd have to pay the full price. In shared equity, the steward organization puts some money into the housing, bringing the cost of it down to the buyer to a level that's more affordable to them. Then time passes, and you're going to sell it. Now, let's say that you haven't fully paid off your share of the mortgage, because it isn't like it's a 30-year mortgage. Say it's a 14 years into the sale. So you walk away with the equity that you have paid off, where you've paid on the principal, not the interest of the loan. The steward leaves their money in the house to keep it permanently affordable. And then you share the appreciation, and the steward puts that back into the house to make it even more affordable or to account for inflation. And you walk away with the equity that you've earned and your share of the appreciation. So this is an example. It's a little detailed. But it shows that if the resident puts in 85% of equity at the beginning, when they sell it, they've paid off 71% of the principal. They walk away. Well, let's see. They've paid off 14,000 of the principal, and they walk away with like $22,000 10 years after the sale, which is a whole lot more than, you know, you are likely to walk away with if you've been renting during that period. So the advantages are that it improves the quality of life for individuals through safe living conditions, wealth accumulation, and improved well-being and liberty. And I think I feel that even much more strongly, not just because it's good housing now, but because the rate of foreclosure is almost non-existent in the housing stock that exists of this sort. It's good for communities because there is research showing that homeowners are more likely to be involved in community associations, to vote, to be civically engaged, and that neighborhoods have stronger social networks, and that there's a better maintenance and upkeep and less crime in these neighborhoods. So that's a win for the community. And I have studied this form of ownership in the most inner city, most deteriorated neighborhoods in New York. And even in those neighborhoods, this was true. One of our studies showed that the buildings that went into shared equity had virtually no crime. And this was like during the crack epidemic in Bed-Stuy and Harlem. So it was pretty amazing to me. That's how I became a convert. And for the national economy, one of the issues that got us into the foreclosure crisis to begin with had to do with the way in which the financial globalization and the investment of global capital in these securitized debts ended up taking control out of the hands of the nation and of the locale to control what happens to housing. You can't work something out anymore at the local level between your banker and your buyer very often. And that's probably a gain for people who don't have the income to sustain a risky investment. So that is my talk. And I hope you see it has something to do with human development. I think it does. Are there questions? Anything you'd like to know about? Yes. That, I think, unfortunately, I think that was a one-year drop because we were, you know, there was this, like, huge increase, run-up in the sales price of housing and then this precipitous, right now what it is housing isn't moving, but you can't sell it for what it's worth. I was at a discussion this morning where the people who in banks and nonprofits and so on were complaining that they can't get appraisals that make any sense to them, and they were figuring, you know, there's people don't actually know how to appraise it because there are no sales, and so it's very difficult right now. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In their lives. And are you seeing that, is there any movement in any banks at all that it seems to me to be cheaper and a benefit to everybody to have some sort of, you know, security net in place where somebody's behind $1,000 and that's going to make the difference of them making their payments versus foreclosing?
It does make sense, and that's something that, especially since we had such high-powered funders of our research, we were asking them about this, and at the time, they were puzzled. They were kind of like, how come they're not getting through the modification department? But things have come out since then. One is that now that it's a crisis and it's understood not to be an individual-by-individual problem, if the banks... when the banks write down a loan, when they say, okay, we're going to share the loss in the value of this property with you so that the total loan value is less, which is what's required to make it work in this climate for most people, they have to show a loss on their books. And if it were one house or two house or a small amount, that wouldn't be a problem. But right now, it would be a massive loss. And there's been resistance to that. And today at the meeting I was at, there were people from Pinnacle and U.S. Bank there and so on. And they were saying that they think the banks may do that now, that everybody knows that they're going to have to take a loss sometime, and at least if you do it now, everybody else will be taking it, so you won't be at a competitive disadvantage. But so far it hasn't happened. Part of it is they're a little overwhelmed. Part of it is... they still haven't figured out a lot of the problems attendant on loan securitization, because these different tranches of securitized debt had sometimes limits on how many loans in the pool could be modified. So if you could only modify 10% of the loans in a pool, but 50% of the loans are underwater, nobody's saying, okay, well, we'll do that. No, but it makes sense at the international investor level too. Something seems better than nothing. But I had a banker explain this to me, and if you have a high enough, like there's a list of debtors, you know, and who are going to get paid off, and let's say they're 200,000 loans in this pool, okay? some of them are going to keep paying their mortgages. So the people who are first in line are still going to be getting these high yields on their securitized debt obligation because they're first in line. And nobody really knows where they are in the line right now. So they're betting that, well, even if in some neighborhoods more than 25% of homes are in foreclosure or delinquency. But even then, they're betting, well, 75%, maybe I'll be the one who gets up there. So it's there's a lot of, the incentive structure is still not there for homeowners to get a fair deal. And I think the form of evaluation, and this is like more the kind of societal norm issue that's problematic, is there's a belief that this burden shouldn't be shared, that homeowners don't have sort of equal rights in the workout of this kind of a thing, which is sort of what we came to as the underlying norms in the home ownership situation. One of the other good things about shared equity is that homeowners are on the governance boards for these organizations. So I think that also gives them more rights. Are there any other questions here? Okay, well, you've been a good audience. Thank you for coming, and